me say what I wanted to do today, then I will allow to emerge whatever actually happens today. I did write a piece a month or so ago, and it is on the agenda, and it is called Intelligent Design of the Story of Evolution, No Need for Drawing Lines in the Sand. It has an associated forum, as all Serendip things do, and it has been a reasonably active forum. And so rather than rehearsing the original story, what I wanted to do was to take advantage of some of the things that have been said in the forum about it and see how the story is evolving, so to speak. Say I'm not prepared to be attacked on the original story, although there have been some quite interesting attacks in the forum, and so.
I don't like those forums, because if you put your what you think down in writing, you're stuck with it.
Well, that's...
You know, people can get you then, but yeah, see, and the nice thing about it is, you're not really responsible for anything you've said.
So oh, now that we're all...
You're on tape, actually.
And Al's listening, Al's listening somewhere in the great...
Precisely that.
No.
How's the brandy tonight?
Anyway, what I wanted to do then was to briefly sketch out the argument of the original paper, but not do that in any detail since that is there. What the original paper did was to start with a series of quotes, excerpt of some of them here. The real trigger was Christopher Schoenberg saying evolution in the sense of common ancestry might be true, but evolution in the neo-Darwinian sense, an unguided, unplanned process of random variation in that selection is not. Any system of thought that denies or seeks to explain away the overwhelming evidence from design and biology is ideology, not science. Them's fighting words from my perspective and from the perspective of the emergence group.
Who is he?
Schoenberg is...
Ratzenberger's replacement.
It's essentially Ratzinger's replacement.
Okay.
And what struck me as amusing, interesting, significant is
that he's not voicing ideology.
The effort now within the Catholic Church is to retrench its position on evolution. The Catholic Church had a fairly forward-looking position on evolution. Schoenberg and others are trying to change it. What Schoenberg is now insisting is that the previous position accepted the idea that humans might have evolved from apes, but it never accepted and would never accept the idea that there was not, in fact, an intelligent designer around somewhere. And it kicked off a fuss. Dr. Hauptmann, our representative scientist, said belief in the supernatural, essentially belief in God, especially belief in God, is not only science, this kind of belief is damaging to the well-being of the human race.
Damage fighting words.
That's equally as stupid. They're
both, also
they're both
fighting
idiots
words,
as far as I can see.
And the point of my article, my essay, was there's no need for this kind of bullshitty drawing lines in the sand.
That's not the same. That doesn't follow.
Well, but that's going to be the argument of the paper. Yes. Them's the drawing lines in the sand from both sides. My assertion. One example of it was an Advent sermon by Lyndon Eaves, who's a minister in Virginia and also a biologist. He said evolution is only a theory, so is God only a theory. The question is whether it leads anywhere.
Which
in both cases.
It. Oh, okay.
In both cases. And that, of course,
Rob would say they're just both surplus meaning.
Yes. And that, of course, resonated with my own thinking. Scientific statements are not either claims or approximations to truth, but provisional stories reflecting human perspectives that get progressively less wrong.
Okay, so now you're done. We can stop you right here.
Good.
What is your standard of progressively less wrong?
Fine.
And what are your criteria for a theory?
Absolutely good, direct questions. So, let us move on. Actually skip through the excerpts from the original paper because emerges in the forum are the kinds of questions we're putting. One of the comments in the forum was, so I think at some point you have to, at least I have to, come back to the proposition that useful means usefully explanatory of something about the universe around us, which means to me has some truth in it that goes beyond whether the story aesthetically satisfies the person hearing it. Some capacity to explain the world in a way that can be collectively validated or tested, that is predictably powerful, that can be reconciled with other stories possessing similar qualities of usefulness. The effort here is to defend some modicum of the concept of truth and reality. And reality. Another comment in the forum along the same lines. For some stories, perhaps those especially can be defined, their relative truth, thanks to him for being not afraid of the word, is relevant. A counter story in the forum was to call this truth, even relative truth, is to hide the action of choice and badness. So one thing I had done in the essay is to try and avoid using the concept of truth. And the responses on the one hand are, there's something important about this concept. And on the other hand, hold on, using the concept even in a modified form is to hide the action choice. So, what I want to argue is, indeed, we can do without the word truth, either capital T or small t, and the problems it creates. And it is actually the problems that it creates more than anything else that we find we need to get rid of the word. I don't need to remind you of the problems it creates. The problems it creates involve humans spending large amounts of money trying to kill one another. But in fact, I've written in another context that truth as a concept isn't really necessary for science at all. And I just want to expand on that idea here. I suggest that we could replace the word truth with the suggested phrasing, some capacity to explain the world in a way that is predictably powerful, collectively validated and tested, and it can be reconciled with other stories possessing similar qualities of truthfulness.
And that was given to you by a forum person.
And that was a forum. That's actually Tim Burke's characterization.
Isn't this what most scientists mean when they say truth?
Yes.
What I wish to say is the word truth, either capital T or small
t,
has some meaning in it, some surplus meaning if you want, that causes people not to hear this, but instead to hear the surplus meaning. And I'm perfectly happy with this. This avoids the surplus meaning problems of the term.
Well, it doesn't, it doesn't. I mean, it only if you put your head in the sand, in a sense, because you put your head in the sand, put a line, and somebody will walk on your head. It happens every time. I mean, the reality is that predictively powerful, collective validation of testing, not the last one, but those two, imply at least an implicit assumption that there is a reality independent of the knower that is responsible for predictive power and is responsible for the communal validation, the communal norms of validation and testing being actually, testing being validated. So in a sense, hidden in that is none, now it doesn't have to be truth in any absolute sense, but hidden in that is nonetheless the presumption that there is something outside the knowing process to be known. And that therefore, as knowledge about that thing outside the knowing process to be known gets better and better, why not call that progressive approximation to some truth? I mean, we're never going to reach it. It's not even reachable. But I do think that it's, I mean, I think it's just putting it in pragmatic terms is not really getting rid of the problem.
Let me continue along exactly this line. The difference between truth and this, I actually assert, is not just fiddling with words. It actually has a deep underlying significance. Note that in the above, there is a inherent context dependency. The context dependence is the perspective of an author or an authorial collective that is predictively powerful, can be collectively validated or tested, and reconciled with other stories, implies the existence of somebody who has particular ways of doing these things and is concerned about being able to do them, at a minimum.
That's not what I said, but it does that as well, I agree.
Okay. Because it does that, I assert that this is importantly and profoundly different from truth with surplus meaning, which offers the notion that there is something being described which is independent of the observer. And my assertion is this context dependence is inherent in any description. And so while there may indeed be something out there, no problem with that, the description being given of it always should be understood to have an authorial perspective.
Certainly. But if it was
truth
only...
Truth is not understood as having an authorial perspective.
I would agree with that, but there's a difference between truth and the description of truth, right?
Fine.
It's the description of truth that has the authorial perspective.
That's correct.
If it weren't for the existence of something beyond truth,
yes,
not beyond truth, beyond the description, then in fact, we would all be in a collective hallucination.
I'm fine.
So all I'm saying is that it implies something that exists. Now, you know, I think that it's important to keep that distinction in mind.
I'm perfectly happy
and
with the distinction. What I want is to get rid of the word truth because people hear it as denying the significance of an authorial perspective. And there is always an authorial perspective.
Right.
But so Paul, couldn't you argue that, or couldn't believers in proponents of intelligent design argue that they also have an authorial collective
perspective, yes,
and that, I mean, one of the arguments we're hearing about teaching this stuff is not merely that there's an alternative viewpoint, but if we take a vote,
no question,
the people want to hear this.
All I am asserting at the moment is we should replace truth with some description that acknowledges there's always an authorial perspective.
No problem with that. That's absolutely.
We will then come to the question, how, in fact, do we discriminate among things that have an authorial perspective? The wish has been to assert that what science does lacks an authorial perspective, and it can be defended on that basis. I'm denying that it can be defended on that basis.
I don't think you're going to get any argument on that.
And we then, as I'll argue in a moment, need to figure out much more carefully than we normally do on what basis science can be defended.
You have three criteria up there already, right?
Fine. That will come back. Yes, you got it. That's part of what we're going to get to.
But those, well, okay, because when you come to the issue of natural selection, random variation in natural selection versus intelligent design, those criteria do not help all that much.
Sounds like the line
yes,
is the same.
You're exactly correct.
Yeah.
You're exactly correct. Okay. So, the difference between calling something truth and calling something this other thing is not just that the words, it's above, it's important, it has the authorial dependence.
And is there a word for this other thing?
At the moment, the word that Tim suggested is predictably powerful, can be collectively validated and tested, and what we're going to discover is that's not enough. But let me work through it and get there. So, truth denies or appears to deny the significance of the real perspective. It also tends to ignore the fundamental uncertainty about future validity and the potential existence of other equally good stories.
Okay. Can I go back?
For all three reasons, we've got to get rid of truth.
Yes, sir. Rob, sir. Rob's, so this is just sort of kind of like different versions of Hume. Okay, there's different interpretations of him. And my preferred interpretation is, this is a long, I think Rob's one, is that you have to distinguish from, you have to distinguish the process of science, which has all this authorial perspective, blah, 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 from the actual sort of, you know, reality. And, okay, and so we're going to draw our line, I think, that we're happy to agree with the view
yes.
that in the there's a sociology of science
yes.
in which all kinds of crazy things can
yes.
happen,
yes.
but ultimately, because there isn't a reality exterior to all these authors, that is, and if you have methods where your standard of validation and testing, blah, blah, somehow conform back to that reality,
yep.
that in the long run, that the authorial perspective is the bubble on the wave, and reality is the wave.
Yes, I understand. And what
okay,
I want to do is to try and give you a way to do this that doesn't depend on hanging on to something which you can't possibly know anything about anyhow, which is reality.
But we can see the wave. We can see. We can
well,
see
things
the
about
wave.
Reality.
I disagree.
You cannot
in the sense
ever,
that
but we'll come to that.
And you need
I
to do that
too. Ever experience
you
reality,
have,
but that doesn't mean you can't know
yes,
about
you'll
it.
You'll come to it, but
you
the
fundamental. This sentence over here is terrible, but okay, you have this concept of getting a less wrong. I'm perfectly happy with that.
He's an idealist. I said it,
right,
said it
totally,
months ago.
Right,
I said it months ago,
right,
I'll stay. I'll
right,
come right back.
Right.
Paul is an idealist.
Right, and I said, as I said months ago, you can dress him up, but you can't take him anywhere.
Well, it's hard to dress him up, too.
Okay, well, not Paul, but ideals in general.
Let's pursue the argument. So what we're essentially agreed on so far is for
we are?
Authorial perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
For
I think we can all agree that
practical
there's an
purposes,
perspective.
There is
yeah,
always authorial.
That's just bias or prejudice,
okay,
right?
But
just to dumb it down so I understand it.
You're trying to say
yeah,
that
okay,
truth,
just
the relationship
just
between
that
truth
it's,
and this perspective
it's, even if it's collective, so
is,
it doesn't have to necessarily be biased.
You have a collective bias.
But
it's
there's
either
a point of view.
Okay.
Disconnected,
point.
Or I guess most of scientists
yeah,
believe that it is tightly connected.
What I'm saying is, irrespective of whether there is a reality out there, we can all agree that the descriptions being made of it at any given time have authorial perspective.
Right.
Yes.
And are contingent on history and society
fine,
and culture and a
but
lot of
that's
right,
where we are.
Right.
Okay. That's what
but
my
point.
So
no, go ahead.
No,
wait, I know where he's going, so
I mean, okay, so you have this sentence, getting it less wrong, which we have no problem with, is different from getting it more right.
Yes.
We do have a problem with, because for us, there's just up and down arrows. And what do you have here that's not that?
Okay, what I am saying, the reason why getting it less wrong is different from getting it more right, is I can get less wrong locally. I don't need a presumption of a reality in order to get less wrong locally.
How so?
All I need locally is a story that accounts for a set of observations, a new observation which cannot be accounted for by that story. That will create a new story which is less wrong.
But I maintain that's also more right.
It may be,
okay,
but leave it open.
All right,
I understand
it's what I'm trying to do.
But,
well, so but let me just put before you go on because I think it's important. So basically, you're simply talking about falsifiability.
Yes.
Okay.
That's all. But local falsifiability.
Yeah, sure.
Right. That's all.
I have no problem with it.
Okay. And what I'm going to try and show you, and what actually the paper several years ago says, is local falsifiability is all you need to account for everything science has ever done. and it's all you need to account for anything it'll ever do. That's all you need.
No.
But I don't want to finish that.
Yeah, let's not go there.
I don't think we
want to
go there.
Let's not go there. Plug in Coon, right, and what, in your language, you know, you can just draw your little two mountains here, that what a paradigm shift might be is a jump from one mountain to another mountain.
Yes.
And that so
can
that
be
science
done,
does do that.
That can be done based on local falsifiability.
Well, I thought science was about extending the local.
We'll come to that. Just you're going to get there.
And also, I don't know that we want to go there, but that the hypothesis testing part of science, I agree with. But there's also the hypothesis formation. There's the theory building.
Yep.
There's the inductive part of science, and those are not characterized by local falsifiability.
Absolutely, I agree.
Okay, so it's 100%. Not all of science that
no,
can be explained.
Absolutely
by
not.
Okay, fine.
Absolutely not.
Can I rephrase this maybe is that you could you can publish a lot of papers getting it less wrong, but it doesn't necessarily take you in any particular direction.
Sure it does. It takes you
out. It takes you out. Not up, but out.
Out.
Yes, it takes you, it gives you a larger and larger array of observations of which you have an adequate description.
And a larger and larger set of things that you know are less right, i.e. more wrong.
That's correct. It gives you that's right. It eliminates a lot of possibilities.
It eliminates
it's continually eliminating possibilities.
More and more data.
And at a very abstract level, we're not going to go there, but at a very abstract level, the mistake that Popper made was to believe that eliminating possibilities reduces the number of possibilities.
Well,
and in fact, it doesn't.
No,
there's also another serious problem with falsifiability, right? Which is that you can't actually falsify any theory. But
let's not go there.
You can't prove it and you
can't
falsify it?
Let's, for the
because
moment.
Of method, right? It's always theory plus method predicts observation. You don't get the observation, your method could be screwed up. So logically, no theory can be falsified. You can always hold on to the theory, you just change your method.
Let's, for the moment, stay with this notion that in practice, a scientific story always has an awful lot. And the question then is, how does one discriminate between stories, given that they all have authorial perspective? That's the key issue. On the way there, the paper on which this paper is based is a paper called Science of Storytelling. And the question that gets posed by a challenge forum is the concept of story appropriate or useful? I suggest that it is at a political level. I use it all the time in teaching about evolution, and responses that I get to it are like this one, presenting evolution as a story is, I think, very useful and diffuses the potential for damage in espousing evolution as the version smart people. There are a lot of people out there who are upset by being told that evolution is true. They will, in fact, think about evolution much more effectively and sympathetically if they're offered it as a sort of practical.
Did you know that the fact? See, I actually disagree. This is the difference between putting your head in the sand versus a line in the sand.
No, I've been doing it.
You've been doing it.
Yeah, I mean, literally for a number of years now, I've been working with populations of teachers and students who come from fairly deeply religious background. And this is the experience.
And that's probably true for all stories, right? Even religious stories.
Oh,
I would suggest it's true for all stories,
right.
Yes.
It's
but
a way of getting your message into people's
right.
Head.
So I think the notion of story is practically useful. But I want to take on the deeper question. And again, I'm quoting from Tim in the forum. The consistent problem or concern I have with Paul's attachment to the concept of stories as he sees it, despite the fact that I'm almost equally attached to a very similar way of thinking about a great many things, which is to say Tim may be fighting as much with himself as he is with me, is that it's difficult to make his judgment that some stories are more useful in some fashion.
Well, it's worth pointing out that Tim, as a historian, of course, is always working with stories, and the criteria which you use to make that judgment in history are not the criteria you use to make it in science.
That's exactly the question. I want to suggest that, in fact, the criteria that are used to discriminate between the stories are not, in fact, so different in science than they are in any place else, but let's go into it in some detail. The challenge that's been set to me by Tim is, how do you discriminate between, if you acknowledge authorial dependence, how do you discriminate between the stories? That's the question.
We're waiting. Let's see what I
think. All right, so at this point now, we're replacing truth with useful. And now we're going to get to how
we
figure out what
we haven't gotten.
Just try to discriminate. How are we going to discriminate amongst stories?
Let's go.
Yeah.
Okay. Come on. Let's go.
I want to see what's there. Move the slide up.
I want to suggest.
Move the slide up.
Perhaps this difficulty, the challenge of how to discriminate between stories, feature rather than a bug. Being required to make explicit what one means by useful is itself more useful for others and oneself than characterizing or justifying what one is doing by appeals to some unverifiable non-local truth or reality.
Right, we.
Let's try it.
Yes.
Let's see if
we're
can discriminate.
We're ready.
Right.
We're more than ready.
What I wish to do is to make an effort to discriminate the story of intelligent design, and here I'm going to use the story of intelligent design in minimal form, because I want to make the problem as hard as possible for myself. So, minimal form of the story of intelligent design is, way back at the beginning, somebody had something in mind and set the whole thing in motion to achieve that. Minimal intelligent design. Mm. And I want to try and discriminate that story from evolution in its extreme form, i.e., the story that everything is emergence, that there was no planner, no intention, no nothing, ever, anytime, anywhere.
That's not the extreme form, that's the form.
No, there are modified forms of it. In fact, I myself hold to a modified form of it. Once storytellers came into existence, intelligent designers existed.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, does everybody understand? I'm not talking here intelligent design in Bishop, whatever the hell his name was.
Sure.
We're talking minimal intelligent design and evolution in extreme form.
So, Paul, your version of intelligent design then include the possibility that you start at a million different starting points and you let it go for an infinite amount of time until you get to humans, and then you go back and you replay it from the beginning and take that path? Is that intelligent?
That would be intelligent.
So that's the evolution.
That's God's computer science.
If God is computer scientist, falls for me into the category of intelligent design.
If that's intelligent design, I see that you can't really. There's no.
What I wish to assert is how you discriminate stories depends on the context. And by looking at its dependence on context, I think you will get a much clearer idea of what we mean by science. So let's look at the context. What I assert is, in the context of trying to understand either truth or reality, there is no basis for distinguishing between these two stories. None. They cannot be discriminated. Period. No discriminability on this basis. This context.
Can I rephrase that?
Yes.
Is it fair to say, see, because I think, of course, that trying to find out about truth and reality is what science is all about.
I know, that's why I'm pointing this out.
Therefore, you're not drawing, so you're basically claiming that they're equally they're equally useful from a scientific point of view.
Equally
I'm
useless.
Arguing there is no way to discriminate between them.
Well, that's true, but that's as much a sort of I'm not sure what the right word is, but it's as much a critique of random variation and natural selection as it is a critique of intelligent design. That
yes.
Basically neither of them have any predictive validity.
Neither one of them are conceivably falsifiable.
Falsifiable. They can't be falsified. They're not testable, and they can't. They have
no
predictive. And they have no predictive validity.
Good. So I'm asserting that if we look at this necessity to discriminate between stories in this context, we end up stuck.
That's because you've picked the one version of intelligent design that's completely consistent with. Okay. Fine.
But we're stuck.
Well,
there's no discriminability.
There could be. I mean, if you believe that humans are the end product, then you could do an experiment where you try to get rid of humans, and if you can, then doesn't that falsify the plan to get to humans?
No. What God did was, because he's omniscient,
that's part of the plan.
He ran your programs with every molecule, every atom interacting in every possible way
right.
for all future time. Okay, and then he picked the set of paths that had humans coming out of that.
Yeah.
Including
so
possibly the one in which humans got rid of humans.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is
you can't
falsify
it. Yeah, just forget it. I mean, just we can argue
can
this
I,
forever.
Can I just ask a question?
It's
obvious. Like
there's no
work,
discriminability there.
Right. Can I ask a question, though? Because I don't know where you're going, of course, because we haven't seen the bottom of that. And I've been dying to see the bottom.
Well, we're
going to
get
but,
there.
But wait, but let me just ask a question, because there is one issue that does distinguish these from a scientific point of view.
Yes.
It's not predictability, it's not falsifiability,
yes.
It's not testability.
Yes.
It's the presence of a transnatural entity, right? In other words, random variation and natural selection is a purely natural mechanism. God is not natural. God is supernatural. And so one of the reasons, and I think personally the only reason that scientists really hate intelligent design relative to natural selection is because intelligent design implies the existence and the role, literally a deus ex machina, role of a transnatural figure. And so therefore you're outside the worldview of science, which is a naturalistic world.
Well, it depends on where that transnatural figure comes into the story, right? If it came in from the beginning, then it's beyond science, but if it's happening every moment,
it's still beyond science if it's God, because God is not.
I think it's
natural.
We're going to hang up here, and I don't want to. Let me just say the following. It's a very interesting issue. I want to come back to it. A part of the reason why I'm not comfortable with it, just right on the face of it, is the process of science itself historically has been to transform the supernatural into the natural,
right.
And so I'm not comfortable at the moment saying what defines science is its explanation in terms of the natural, because it has continually been a process of taking what appears
right.
to be supernatural.
But that's
yeah,
why
but that's
intelligent
the whole
design
point.
Is seen as regression.
Right.
I understand that.
It is.
And let's come back to that one, because there's a I think a subtler version of your point that will in fact discriminate those two. But let me come back to it. Okay, so that's one context. A second context is a quote from a play by Bertolt Brecht. The play is Galileo. There is a character in Galileo, a little monk who is a friend of Galileo's, and he and Galileo have an argument about this notion that the earth goes around the sun. And the monk says, my family, my father, very eloquent, his hard-working father and mother, they've been told that God relies upon them. The pageant of the world has been written around them, that they may be tested in the important or unimportant parts handed out to them. How could they take it were I to tell them that they are on a lump of stone ceaselessly spinning in empty space, circling around a second-rate star? What, then, would be the use of their patience, their acceptance of misery?
It's
a different context. And I assert that in this context, the intelligent design story may well be a better story than the evolution.
See, I totally disagree.
If the context is providing a basis for acceptance of misery, if that's the context, then arguably intelligent design is a better story.
I think I see the problem with the faculty anymore.
They have no story for accepting their misery.
They
so they attack the provost.
That's a good joke.
Okay, I actually disagree with this because it, you know, relates to theodicy. You know, why is there evil in the world? Why do the bad things happen? Why is it New Orleans? And it's only by ignoring theodicy that you get your second column, that it's a better story in acceptance of misery. It's people who just will refuse to even think about that problem. Once you think about the problem, it doesn't make acceptance of misery easier. I would say it makes it harder. Because why is there this, you know, person who's giving you a part to play and blah, 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 and then, you know, is totally arbitrary in terms of how he metes out punishment and, okay?
I couldn't agree with you more, and that's why I put the question marks there.
Okay.
But I do think that in this particular context, there is a debatable question as to which story is better.
No, but this, the context isn't...
And serious arguments can be made on the side of the little monkey.
Well, I think the problem that you're having is because the way the context is laid out there is not actually broad enough. I mean, the context is the context of, first of all, belief in God, but more importantly, subjugation of self to God. If in the context that one subjugates oneself to God, then of course it makes the acceptance of one's life, one's role, etc., easier to understand if in fact God is the first mover
but
and everything's been designed.
The other part of this is we're setting a context that, you know, that suggests that the most useful explanation is the one that makes people feel more comfortable.
All I'm trying to do at the moment,
which I think is bullshit,
is to look at the dependence of the value of these stories on context. And I'm going to use that to try and make clearer what we mean by science. I want you to understand that there are different contexts and that they lead to different discriminations between the stories.
But you have, can I just add?
And I want to say this because in our efforts to deal with people who are not scientists, we have to be aware of the context within which they're making the discriminations.
That's the huge...
That's essential.
That would be my biggest criticism of your stories and stories. They're so amoral. We have to, as scientists, get on the bandwagon and realize, let's tell the same story with morality. You can do it.
We'll do it.
I'll show you guys.
We're going to get there.
But let me add one thing, too, which is I think you have to be a little careful in that you have to be careful that you, because you've chosen these contexts, right?
And of course.
Okay. And many of the, and the contexts at least that you've showed us so far are actually contexts that are de facto outside the scientific worldview.
Rob, I'm not worrying about what's going on in science. I'm worrying about the relation between science and the rest of the world.
I
and
understand
for that purpose,
but,
I got to know the
but
other
But I
contexts.
Think you can, even within the scientific worldview, like comprehensibility, for example, what story makes things more understandable, you can make a case that intelligent design is a better story than random
we'll
variation
get to
and
it.
Natural
we'll
selection.
We'll get to it. I agree. I'm just trying to make it clear what the context is within the scientific community and how it relates to other contexts.
Is this tautological? I mean, aren't you just saying that what the question is going to determine the usefulness or the appropriateness of the answer? So if the question is, how do I make my misery acceptable, story A answer.
Indeed saying that, yes.
I disagree, though. I mean, I think the science philosophy, if you had a choice, say on Saturday or Sunday, you could either go to church or synagogue, or you could go back to the lab and try to, you know, pull yourself out of your misery. Which is time better spent?
Lab.
It's an open question.
Depends.
It's not settled by any means. It isn't. Let's look at one more context and then we'll move closer to science. If I'm taught there's a God I'm responsible to, I know I have to treat people right. But if there's no creator to answer to, it changes your whole lifestyle. Then it's just survival of the fittest. That's where our society is headed. That's why we have so many of the problems.
That's Pascal's wager, isn't it? Be good because
this
God
is
might be there.
Somebody standing outside the trial in Dover this week.
I did think of philosophy.
And this is a great question.
And that's what I'm trying to get you to understand.
Is
in this context,
this is the scope's context.
It is also unclear which of the two stories is better.
Well,
no,
I would say it's,
but you made a claim there, better and less. I don't think that's true at all. I think it's unclear.
They
absolutely.
Had question marks.
The other thing, is, Paul, you set up a dichotomy saying that the only way one can think about God is in the context of, I mean, why is it that if you have evolution, you no longer have God?
Or morality.
Right.
So that's
just
about morality.
You know,
I didn't set it up. The woman did.
I think the woman's got a good question there.
Well, I think she's got a very good question.
I
that's
don't.
But I'm saying is, you know, she's making an assumption that if you have evolution, you have no God.
She is indeed.
Well, she's a jerk.
No,
yeah,
that's
what
you can't do.
Okay, but
natural moralities, natural values.
Yeah.
Yes, maybe
God
there is. And
there
maybe
is.
Indeed
well, we
you can get morality out of an emergent process. I think you probably can. But as far as she's concerned, you can't, and therefore the context for the question is.
And she's
useless.
Right, because the amount of stuff
and
that
she
we ever read.
Right.
Well, but you also don't have
to.
You don't have to get it out of an emergent context if emergence led to intelligent design, which it did, which we all already know. So morality can still be intelligent. I mean, let me make an important point. I think there's a difference between the mechanism. See, the problem is you set the problem up by taking these extremes.
Like
you set it up in a way which is sort of self-fulfilling. I mean, the reality is that we're talking about two mechanisms here. One is intelligent design as a mechanism. Every building on this campus
yes.
was intelligently
yes.
designed. And one is random variation and natural selection.
That's right.
The stuff that Doug does. Reality is that if I were going to build a campus, I would not turn to Doug, as much as I love him and think that he's fantastic. I would go to an architect. So the reality, you know, the point is these mechanisms.
You haven't seen my building.
You forget God from them.
They're pretty.
There's
cool.
two. There's even leaving God out of it, because intelligent design is really an argument about a mechanism. It's also an argument about who has the mechanism, who's the intelligent designer. But the mechanism needs to be separated from that one.
And all I'm saying is it's going to depend on the context. Well, that's all. So far, that's all I'm saying.
I'm an atheist, and I have morality. Why? Because I believe
Doug,
in this.
I'm not denying it.
Well, I'm going to tell you why. Here's a story to tell that woman why she's wrong.
Oh,
she's
you
wrong.
Go,
no, no,
you
no, no,
go
no.
tell the woman. That's the point. Don't tell me.
I'm not saying the woman's right. What I'm saying is she has the statement she has made is to a first approximation. This is a thing where most people think it's a true statement. And in fact, there's very little, I mean, think of all the science courses you've taken, and I mean, unless you're taking philosophy, and even there, how much have they used the scientific method to prove moral right and wrong?
Yeah.
Like, almost never, right?
No, but if
so,
you believe in this web of causality, then your actions have repercussions that cause things that...
Yeah, but why should you, you know, that's exactly
friends,
what I'm having,
in all
the
honesty,
debate I'm having my daughter.
I think it would be... I think it'd be wonderful to spend a whole session on whether morality can come out of emergence. All I want for the moment is the recognition that Doug thinks yes and Mark thinks no, and that's enough from my point.
No, what I think.
Let me go one more.
We're trying to get to the science.
Okay, so we can
attack.
I just wanted to make sure that everybody didn't agree with that woman.
Fine.
Right.
Good. Let me quickly go through one more that turned up at the forum. In an attempt to answer the question you posed, why should we accept our need for one another? Does that help us to, in that context, can you discriminate the two possibilities? My assertion is no.
historically, the notion of an intelligent designer has been used both to promote a sense of togetherness and to promote otherness and aggression against each other. So I don't think you can discriminate in that context either. Where can we begin to discriminate? What context are you going to discriminate? Well, how about if we take some capacity to explain the world in a way that is predictively powerful, can be collectively validated or tested, and that can be reconciled with other stories? That's the notion of truth that Tim offered us. It's my assertion that that gives us no more ability to discriminate than any of the other contexts.
What happened to very bad, bad, very good, bad?
We'll get back to that one. I put them slightly out of order. I apologize. That doesn't allow us to discriminate between the two.
What about the validation and testing part of it?
The validation and testing doesn't allow us to discriminate. They're both
tests.
Yeah, it's
random variation and natural selection. Yeah.
Yes, you can.
Oh.
Well,
it's been done.
Not
in
if
lab.
You take this extreme view of intelligent design that it happens.
This is
way
the,
back
this is the yeah, this is the evolution story though. Not that you can get something out of. See, there's the distinction. That's the one I was trying to make before. Of course you can in the here and now look at random variation natural selection, but in fact there are far, far, far more observations that are explicable by intelligent design, like all the buildings on this campus, for example. If you just look at the here and now, you can both test intelligent design, you can test random variation and selection, and there are all sorts of observations that demonstrate that both of them work all the time. But more probably for intelligent design. If
what?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Intelligent design doesn't have to have God. It has to be intelligent design. And we intelligently design all sorts of things. We live in a world that's intelligently designed. This building is intelligently designed. Right?
Yeah, but I'm talking about
the
biology.
Mechanism, but separate the mechanism. Well, even in biology, I think you can argue, for example, if the only question is explicability, does it make sense? Complex systems could certainly have been intelligently designed. We know there are all sorts of ones now. I mean, like a factory, for example, is intelligently designed. Why couldn't the body have been intelligently designed?
Well, actually, though, there's a problem because you can't look at a building and know the process that it took. I mean, it may have been evolved through some genetic program, and you're looking at the result. So,
except you can study it over time.
So, point is,
for
the moment, only that. Even if you take this modified notion of truth that allows for authorial perspective and all that sort of stuff, you still don't have an ability to discriminate. What I want to suggest is, if you take that and add the ability, the inclination to summarize the widest array of observations in a form that in turn generates the widest array of new observations and new stories, then you clearly have a way to discriminate between the two.
But that's a challenge for the
intelligent design story has been around for thousands of years and has failed to generate any interesting new observations or new stories since probably the birth of Christ. It's a stupid bet. It's a really bad bet.
But only if you're interested in this.
Evolution.
I mean, this is contrived.
I mean,
it's
you
not contrived. That's
no,
what I'm
just,
trying to get
just
across.
Just some
to
people
you.
Don't care about new observations.
We understand
miracles?
That.
What are you talking about?
But what I'm telling you is everybody is working from a different context. The only basis on which we, as scientists, can legitimately discriminate the stories is in this context.
But that's a
and
challenge.
That's the context that we use as scientists.
More wider and wider scope.
Wider and wider scope and generating new
yeah.
questions.
See, okay.
Observations.
What about the
that's
grilled
the
cheese
only
sandwich
context.
With the Virgin Mary in it? I mean, there's a new observation, a new story. This
but
thing that
it
was
doesn't
on
go
eBay.
Anywhere.
What do you
selling?
Mean? How
a
many
selling a grilled cheese sandwich?
Yeah,
going
it was sold for like about $40,000-$50,000. This woman made a grilled cheese sandwich, and it had
from her perspective, authorial, the Virgin Mary, a picture of the Virgin Mary in the grilled cheese sandwich. She then put it in like a Tupperware thing next to her, misproves the supernaturalness of it, put it in a Tupperware thing next to her bed.
Plastic.
And no mold grew on it for many years. And then she put it on eBay.
Dried out.
And
well, that's a story, I have to say.
Fine.
So that's a new story.
Yes, I agree.
It's in the intelligent design
yes.
mode.
Yes.
Okay.
And it won't go
there's
anywhere.
There's more of those. There's
and
every day somebody's
happen.
Hands
on and it
the
won't
milk.
Go anywhere.
I don't know.
It will not be generative. Put
well,
it
you,
different.
I think now you got
it.
Now we got
it. Well, but there you're begging the question.
No, I'm not begging it. I'm going to explain it. I got it. I'm not begging.
Are we
it.
Continuing this?
I'm in fact defining the question. Yeah,
so now what generative means, right? I mean, I would say,
like,
so I'm saying, I mean, if you look at television, there's endless, you know, Touched by an Angel, there's endless stories that are generated from the intelligent design model.
Yeah, you're just pushing the question back one level. So what makes generative?
That's,
I mean, what counts as generative?
Look, don't tell me I'm just doing something. A, I've established that we have to be able to discriminate between stories. B, I have said that discriminating between stories depends on context. C, I've suggested to you what the context is. It then follows from that that yes, we have to have a definition of generativity. I'm prepared to offer you that.
Okay, and then will you come back to this question? It seems like the word wider is a challenge to locality. I mean, if you start by saying that all stories are local or all contexts are local, if you're going to say that the most generative or the best stories are ones that produce wider, account for wider arrays of observation, then there's a challenge to the locality. I mean,
absolutely.
So that's what this would distinguish on. The local's
not
so local.
Not alone, but that's a part of it. Then.
Okay, so you want to carry on this conversation
sure.
in 2 weeks' time?
Sure.
We won't meet next week, but then the week after.
And then the religionists could say that science is local, that they have a wider span that includes the supernatural. I mean, I don't know how your local,
absolutely,
how your wider gets you.
We will continue. You can send people that way.